something happening here.
This is Laura Hamburg with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll be hearing from Diana Wiedemann, an Albion architect and county planning commissioner. In the early 70s, Weed, as she's known, helped found Trillium, an all-women's commune in Albion. As a girl in the 50s, Weed was forced to give up her dream of being a professional athlete. And as a college student in the late 60s, she saw how men, white men, came to dominate the anti-war movement. It was a time, Weed says, when the playing field for women was very narrow. That was all about to change.
I'm Diana Wiedemann, and I'm known as Weed, or Weedy. I've lived in Albion since 1973.
And Weed, where and when were you born?
I was born in Southern California, in Pasadena, and that year was 1951.
Can you talk a little bit about your life growing up, being a kid in Pasadena, and about some of those formative experiences and maybe some people that stood out to you that sort of helped shape who you are?
My early life in Southern California was pretty much resolved around having brothers and an older sister. Basically, we grew up kind of in a transitional place where a suburb that was on the edge of ranch lands, horse ranch, and egg farms. By the time I was 10 years old, or 12 years old, they were gone. And I think that always left an imprint to me. Then fast forward another 5-10 years and living at the beach along Southern California beaches, it became clear that population growth with not good planning started impacting all our favorite beach spots, that we couldn't even get to some of them. You know, my parents, I had a pretty middle-class upbringing. I had loving parents who were there for us. So I had a pretty supportive environment to reach adulthood.
Were there any political movements happening as a young woman that made you think that I want to be involved in this? I'm wanting to find something that suits me spiritually or physically.
I would say I was really a good athlete. And when I tried out for a Little League, I was not allowed to play. And my brothers, who ended up, my older brother was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys and the LA Dodgers, and he always said you were as good as I was, but you couldn't play. Now, what that did to me as a 7 or 10-year-old started making one really conscious about, we didn't have the language, but it was clearly we needed to do something as women. And it, obviously, it was an early feminist moment in time.
What year is this that you're athletic and you're trying out for Little League?
This was probably 1958 to the end of the 50s. By the time I basically came of age in high school, which would be the mid-60s, it was really clear there was a discrepancy around gender. It was just an automatic for, I think, my generation of women that we could really see we are outside the box, right? How do we get in where equality? And I'll give you this, the simplest example was when I was graduating from high school and ready to go to college, and I met with my high school counselor, and I asked him, well, he had a book that looked like it had 1,000 pages of job descriptions for careers. And he said to me, these were his words, well, you could be a nurse or you could be a teacher like your older sister. And I looked at him and I said, now this was 1968. And I looked at him and I said, is that all you have in that 1,000 pages? There's a nurse or a teacher? And those are fabulous professions. But I just said, we could stop now because you're not going to be helpful. So that was the umbrella all of us were growing up with. And as women, we really, so when we look at the, you know, early feminist movements, for me, it started with Little League.
What did you think you wanted to be when you were younger?
Oh, I wanted to be a professional athlete. And that just was stopped. And so what was great was my generation and the following generations, we ended up with Title IX. And voila, you know, now you have fabulous women's sport and World Cup soccer. And It's a change, but we still have a lot more to go, as everybody knows.
Back then, when you look back at that, how did that lead you and pave a way for you to go and find those opportunities?
Now I'm in college, and it's like the late 60s, first couple years of the 70s, but the late 60s, and we have the anti-war demonstration. We have Vietnam War going on. And we were at a meeting on how we're organizing against the Vietnam War. And I went to the University of San Diego down in San Diego, and it was one of these stellar moments where when we were picking the people who were in charge, all the white men stood up. And what happened was, without a beat, all the women, all the Latinos, all the African Americans basically walked out. And we came back the next day and we basically said, hey, this cannot be anymore. We didn't have the language. We understood racism and we a bit of it, and we understood the needs for feminism at that point, but nothing was in order. So what happened at the university at that time, we started a women's studies program. We started the what was called Chicano program and the Black Studies program. And that all kind of came out of the same area of the anti-war movement, because all these issues were just percolating. It was just throbbing in society. And then you have the hippie movement on top of that, and of course the advent of birth control, which allowed the social mores to make a big shift and sexual revolution happen.
So when and how did you come to Mendocino County?
Well, I had some friends who, they inherited some money. They came, they asked me, where should we look for land? So I gave them the coast from Navarro to Mendocino and look for land. And that's how my friend bought 20 acres where I still live with a group of women. That was probably 1972, when my friend came back from purchasing the 20-acre piece on Albion Ridge. I said, well, would you mind if I go and homestead it? And that was 1972, and we got up here, and I came up with my woman partner at the time, Julie Rumble, that I came up in 1973 to homestead.
What did you call that piece of land and that commune?
That commune eventually got it. Well, it was Julie and I, and then our friends started dribbling up, you know, and we reconverted all the chicken coops and the outbuildings, et cetera, and eventually built a main house. And that, we eventually called that woman's land, Trillium.
What does Trillium mean?
Well, Trillium was, we had the redwood forest by the creek behind our property, and it was full of Trillium flowers. And so we thought, this will be a perfect name. So it was kind of like, you know, we were throwing tons of ideas out, but we saw this flower and we thought, oh, this makes sense. We'll just call it Trillium. It's a 20-acre parcel up Albion Ridge. It's in the third fog belt zone, which is meaningful when you live near the coast. And it has about a 7-acre huge meadow, and it has a creek behind the property with second growth trees. And then it has transitional pygmy between the meadow and Albion Ridge Road. It was an old homestead where we stayed was the main part of the land.
When you imagine and co-create with other women to have a women's commune, how is that different than having a men and women's commune? How would you describe that? What was the vision of it?
I would say, well, there is a bit of a difference. I think for us, and I'll speak for myself, our commune, we were all lesbians. And it wasn't just heterosexual women. It was all lesbians. And what it became clear, and this is, mind you, in the 70s, that we really needed to figure out a way to have family, because our birth families or our blood families, we were alienated from them. You know, we were outside the system. People was pretty homophobic those times. And so we needed to figure out a way to create a family, because we knew it would, you know, we chose a lifestyle that made sense to us, right? And we were having a good time. So it was about creating a family. And I think that was the underlying theme of why we came together as a commune. I think it allowed us to take our education and take it a little deeper and get it a little more advanced, so that Red Wing became a registered nurse. Julie became a bilingual teacher. I became an architect. So it gave us the support system to make that transition. And our commune, which was different, in Albion Ridge, and it was a time, so let's look, the late 60s, the 70s especially, were very communally, people were forming collectives and communes. The Albion had several communes, and it was flourishing. There was the Country Woman magazine taking place. There were the Thai Farm commune. There was Salmon Creek, which was a heterosexual. And then there was Table Mountain. And Table Mountain and Trillium, my commune, we were the communes that shared monies, which made it actually a whole nother layer of how you get to the deeper places with each other. When you're in a capitalist society and you share monies, you kind of take a lot of layers away. And I think in the high point of that, it was really bonding and really family, and we had a great time. And then in the 80s, when I feel like Reaganomics came in and we had the political pressures of the Code Wars and all the communes were being turned in by different organizations that were basically not understanding our way of life. So there was pressure on how come the communes didn't quite survive.
Let's talk about the money for the moment. How did you organize that?
It became clear to all of us. I mean, mind you, none of us really had a lot of money. So we were pretty homogenous as a group. We were pretty much white middle class women that we, our history where we came out of, or white working class women. But we were very much, our socioeconomic structure was pretty close, which made it easier. We decided, it just made it simpler to, whatever money we made went into a pot. And we would meet every week or every other week on Sunday and figure out what our needs were and who was going to be on the house duty, who was cooking. And so for me, who really, I'm not really a cook. I ended up doing the construction and getting into construction as a way of life. It was really great that I only had to cook dinner one night a week, you know, and clean the house one night a week. And I would love to mend the fences and, you know, build the buildings, but I didn't have to center the cooking. And that was Red Wing or other of my communards. Everybody had their places where they were, their expertise. So I think for the most part, it allowed us to figure our daily life in a way that kind of worked for us. And it was a time where nobody had a lot of money around us that we were aware of. Not only the communes, everybody who was up here, the Back to the Land movement. People were really living pretty simply. That was part of coming here.
Were you part of Country Women magazine?
Yes, I was part of Country Women magazine, which was great. And I just want to say one thing. When I was in, before I go into where I was part of it, it was so successful. I was invited to go to Paris to restore a 200-year-old farmhouse with seven sisters who were a building collective out of Berkeley. And I went into two bookstores. One was a standard bookstore and one was a woman's bookstore. And there was racks of Country Woman magazine. And it was so popular in France. I was like kind of shocked because from some of my French friends, they would say, well, you may not have the deepest intellectual dialogue, but you really are productive in America. So for me on Country Woman magazine, yes, I participated on several issues, but my favorite part for me was the practical section. That's where I could really offer, whether it was teaching women how to change brakes or doing a tune-up or how to build something.
Were you writing like a how-to column?
Well, In the back, the book was, and I believe Helen Jacobs is going to bring some books later on, but she, there was, it was divided into two parts. There was the theme part, which is the first part. So if it was on international women, a collective met for many, many weeks and came up with writings on the theme. And then the second half of the magazine was the practical section, because it was really important at the time. You have to go back. Women needed to figure out, all over the United States, all over the world, who was milking and how were we doing the milk? Who was really spinning the wool? How do we change brakes on a car? So it was the practical section, I think, for women homesteading was as important as reading what women were doing on a theme.
Weed, can you talk about a time at Trillium or part of the magazine when all of these things came to fruition and you had this moment of, I am living fully in my life. I'm experiencing exactly what I want to, a memory or story you can share?
Yes, I can paint a picture of just a beautiful scene of my life as on a woman's commune. And I have the image, and the image is we're building our main house. There's women coming from some other communes or other parts of the land, and they're coming over, and we're framing the house, and we're building. And some women are bending nails and getting frustrated. Other women are just plowing along and being comfortable with tools. And then there comes Red Wing, who comes over and says, I can't do this. This is just, I'm going, and I'm going to go cook for us. And she comes out with like 10 pies, fruit pies, because she was fabulous as a homemaker in the kitchen and knew food like the back of her hand. And all of us just went, this is fabulous. The richness of it was we were able to really recognize the value of the homesteader, the value of somebody who is bringing garden food in for preparation for the meals. And then the person who's pulling the wire to put the fencing up so that, you know, the wild animals don't get into the garden. I think that's the image. That was a wonderful image for me.
If you've just joined us, this is Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County. I'm Laura Hamburg. I'm talking with Diana Wiedemann, also known as Weed, who helped found the Albion Women's Commune Trillium in 1973. Let's get back to the interview where Weed talks about the early relationships between the Back to the Landers and the old timers.
And the other image I want to share was I had the opportunity to work on land use planning with Eleanor Cervirco. And I have to honor Eleanor Cervirco. If we want to look at the Mendocino town plan and we want to look at this coast and the beauty, Eleanor Cervirco was old timer who raised the consciousness of all her old-time friends, and some of them did not want to hear it, and understood, hey, the environmentalist, this is good. We need to bring them into our fold and teach them about old-time ways here and what we did. And she was such a mentor to myself and others who got involved with environmental issues and protecting the land. I'm happy to say that Eleanor was the 5th District Planning Commissioner in her time, and that had to be, she ended up doing that, I believe, in the late 80s, probably, throughout the late 80s. And I'm going to start picking up that gavel next week as the 5th District Planning Commissioner. So it comes full circle.
Are there any other people that were here previous to the Back to the Landers that you mentioned, Eleanor? Were there other people that combined forces with you that we were able to work with and build coalitions with?
Oh, yes. I think Lauren McDonald, when Redwood Summer, right before Redwood Summer happened, and when there was what became clear, I think, even to the old timers, and like Lauren McDonald, David Cervirco, some of them worked in the woods, and they really saw that when the logging companies were no longer local, when they were Louisiana Pacific from the south, the Masonite lands, and they saw that they didn't really care about the community. I think they got, lights went on for them, too, that something is amiss. I would say, as David Cervirco said to me once, Weed, You know, in my lifetime, he was 80 years old at the time, he said, in my lifetime, we cut down a 2,000-year-old virgin forest. And I'm going to tell you the image so you understand. We were ignorant. When I was a young guy, we were cutting the forest down prior to World War II. Then we kept, after World War II, we really decimated because it brought the chainsaw and more tractors. And he said, when we got to Willits, I was standing with my buddy, and we looked out and we said, where are the trees? He thought the trees went forever. So really, it's education and learning from the past. And he became a environmentalist in his older age and brought in all his old-time buddies to meetings. So it was, and Lauren McDonald saw that when they wanted to clear cut the Albion. That was helpful. And it was hard for them to see this group of hippies and back to the landers come and start acting like we knew that we had answers. And it took probably, I would say, 10 years, 12 years, till we realized, wait a minute, we're neighbors. We're okay. We need to have the dialogue with my neighbors, like we had in our neck of the woods. The Shandells are old timers here and really work the land. And really, eventually, I learned something from John, and as land use planning, John Shandell, is he said, the issue here is you never break down resource lands. If you want a rural community or a rural character, don't let anybody ever break down resource lands, meaning to subdivide. It's the easiest way to keep a rural character in a county.
And we're talking about the legacy or the lasting imprint of the Back to the Landers, particularly in Mendocino County. But I would ask you, Weed, about the legacy of the feminist Back to the Landers.
Well, I think we're still here. And here we are. You know, we're still involved with communities. The legacy would be we are in probably every nook and cranny there is in the world of society here. That's a big difference. I mean, I guess it's kind of a mixed bag, because the mixed bag really is, when I look at the Board of Supervisors, we still are electing mostly white men, and we could be electing white women. So what's that about? Okay, number one. Doesn't mean that these guys aren't doing a great job and we don't support them, but it's an issue to look at. It's something, okay, and then we can look at, I could look at the trades. As an architect, I offer work to people. There are less women in the trades today here than there were in the 70s, late 70s. So what's that about? Now, some guys think, well, what woman would want to do this? This is hard work. And I'd have to say, but you can make really good money. Something's not happening there to open up that door. I would say the legacy is that when I look at most of our boy children who are young men now, or middle-aged men, they are broader. They are broader in how they relate in the world with women on the whole. And that's a legacy.
Do you think it's important to pay attention to this time in history? And what can we come away with?
Well, I certainly do. We look at the last election. What happened that we didn't get somebody who was totally qualified to be elected as a woman, as a president? Well, and we can go in that, yes, it was co-opted and this and that. But we still have a long way to go as women. And we need to keep our eye on our goals of, we need to make sure women are in their power. What gets you in your power? Many things, but one clear thing is that you're self-sufficient. You're self-sufficient economically. You make your choices. And I'll give you a story. My mom said to my sister and I think I was like 14, she was 20 at the time, and she said, you need to get a career, because that way you'll always be able to, if you're not in a happy relationship, you can take charge of your life. And I think that's important. So if I were to say to any young woman, girl, teenage girl growing up, figure out what you like, get into what speaks to you, and develop that, and follow your passion, and that passion, and develop it so that you become self-sufficient. You know, trade or activity you're involved with. because I think it's a personal empowering to be in charge of your life economically. You know, what I want to say is I really appreciate this interview session because I don't think we can put a value on how much we change our culture. And this just, your interviews are giving a moment in time of insights to realize the world around you is 180 degrees different than it was in 1970.
What do you think is left to be done, tapping into that energy that was created in the 70s?
I think when I get out-of-town clients who move here, they want to move here because it's safe, it's beautiful. They like that people they're easy to basically engage with. And they don't realize how many subterranean communities exist from all of us who have lived here a long time. I think how I would like to see my community, where I continue to flourish, I really think we need to figure out a way to embrace the Latin community who is our workforce now, bring them into, we need, and I think that's happening, but I look forward to the day where they really are participating in local politics more and are more able to do that because of the economics and that we open the doors for them to sit with us. I think it's also important to continue the protection of our land use and our environment around us. That's like critical. And I think to keep figuring out ways to be creative with every change of generation. What we did might not be interesting to the 20-year-olds today.
Or it might.
Or it might, right? I think to answer that part about what a legacy might be was anytime they pick up an organic sandwich, they could thank the Back to the Landers, period. As my friends say, we grew up in great times. Coming of age in the 60s for women, coming of age, being able to participate in Back to the Land movement, being able to take those years and turn them into another type of career. Like right now, I'm a licensed architect. So everything kind of was a building block. And remember, I go back to that time when I was 7 years old, not allowed to play. And what happened was if I tie the thread together, we made the playing field really broad for us. And that, I think, was the task of my generation.
We just heard from Diana Wiedemann, who helped found the Albion Women's Commune Trillium in 1973. These short excerpts of Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County, air Thursdays during the news hour. To hear the half-hour program with Weed, tune in Thursday at 3:30. If you've missed Weed's full interview, you can find it on the KZYX website, along with more than a dozen other Back to the Land stories and photos. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, Story Center, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.